Chapter 4. Arson. During the firing of the haystacks, the thought that human beings might be burned added to the sensations that I experienced. I always watched the fires, usually from near at hand, so near, in fact, that I've been asked to give a helping hand. The shouting of the people and the glare of the fire pleased me. During big fires, I always had an orgasm. If you see in my confession sometimes several arsons in one night, then I had no success with the first or the second. I also had an orgasm when I fired the woods. It was a lovely sight when one pine after another was consumed in the flames, fanned by a sharp east wind. That was wonderful. This extract is from the confession of the arch-sexual pervert Peter Curtin, the monster of Dusseldorf. And it introduces us to the most baffling of all sexual abnormalities, pyromania. Even today, little is known of this frightening urge. It's pointedly ignored in most textbooks of clinical psychiatry. Perhaps this is understandable. Anybody can understand a rapist or even a sadist, because there's a fragment of them in every one of us. But how can a normal human being understand someone who obtains sexual satisfaction from watching a fire? We can obtain some insight into this complex process from a confession quoted by Dr. Melvin Reinhardt in his classic study, Sex Perversions and Sex Crimes. He cites the case of a 14-year-old boy who, with three other boys, was smoking cigarettes in a hay barn. Someone unintentionally tossed a cigarette butt into the hay. The barn caught fire, and all four ran away. The boy felt an odd compulsion to stop and watch. He stayed behind in bushes and observed the arrival of the police and the firemen. This could, of course, have been normal curiosity. Most people like seeing a fire. But he also noted that he had a vague sexual thrill from the sight of the flames. As he read about the blaze in the newspaper the next day, he again experienced the same excitement and got a compulsion to go and start another fire. This time the thrill was even stronger. Finally, by the time he was watching his fourth fire, the intensity was so great that he masturbated. He was caught and sent to a reformatory. There are other psychological elements here that we can recognise. For example, his delight as he read the newspaper headlines and thought that no one but he knew who was responsible. This is straightforward ego satisfaction, and it undoubtedly plays a part in pyromania. The psychiatrist Dr. Wilhelm Stekel has commented that most pyromaniacs are unhappy, drifting individuals who feel themselves rejected by society. They often suffer from strong feelings of inferiority. Even so, this fails to explain how or why fire is associated with sexual feeling. It becomes somewhat clearer in another case cited by Reinhardt, involving an extraordinary, complex web of sexual emotions. The father of a family of three girls, all in their teens, had ceased to have sexual relations with his wife. His sexual desires became fixated on the 14-year-old daughter. One day he met her out of school, drove her to a quiet lane, and had intercourse with her. The girl admitted in her statement to the police, "For 2 or 3 months, Daddy removed my panties. Then I began liking it." Like many young girls, she was infatuated with her father. For the next 3 years, they continued to have sexual intercourse 2 or 3 times a week, and he also encouraged her to stimulate him orally. One night, the mother heard her daughter going to the father's bed. There was a violent quarrel, and she threatened to report him to the police. It was after this that he began to brood on killing his wife and one of the other daughters. The third was away from home. He then enlisted the aid of the incestuous daughter, who alleged he said he wouldn't interfere with me any more if I helped him to pour gasoline on the floor. On the afternoon of the murder, he met his youngest daughter, Ruth, aged 13, in the kitchen, and hit her violently in the stomach, knocking her unconscious. When his wife came in, he also struck her with his fists. He was obviously a powerful man, for 3 blows laid her out too. The eldest daughter then came in. They both soaked the kitchen and the unconscious wife and daughter in paraffin. As they left, the man tossed a match into the room. As the place burst into flames, he drove off, went shopping, went for a swim, and then returned home and found the fire engines there and the house burnt out. The empty paraffin cans gave the police the clue to the fire. In this case, it would seem as if the fire was started as an attempt to cover up the crime. Understandably, no policeman of 50 years ago would have assumed that there was any sexual element in the case. On the other hand, there is one highly significant point. In a carefully planned murder, the killer does not leave empty paraffin cans to suggest that the fire was started deliberately. However, every criminologist has observed that there are many cases of murder in which the killer seems to want to get caught. He does something that will provide an obvious clue. For example, parks his car near the scene of the murder, or leave some article of clothing behind. This desire to expiate guilt happens most frequently in cases of sex murder. It appeared to apply to the present case, and was undoubtedly the reason that led Dr. Reinhardt to classify it with other examples of pyromania. After 3 years of sexual intercourse with his daughter, the father felt a burden of guilt, and the fire was a strange, twisted attempt to burn away the guilt. This could well resolve the otherwise inexplicable relation between sex and fire. Fire is a symbol of purity, and the self-divided pyromaniac simultaneously longs for purity and is sexually excited by it. This is confirmed by another curious observation made by many criminologists, that the pyromaniac often feels the need either to urinate or to empty his bowels when he sees the flames. In The Sexual Criminal, Dr. Paul DeRiver mentions two female pyromaniacs, middle-aged, sexually frigid women, who felt a compulsion to stoop down and urinate as they watched the fires they had started, and a burglar who had to hide in bushes and empty his bowels after he had watched a fire. In all these cases, the criminal confessed to an immense feeling of relief and purification after the act, all of which seems to suggest the psychological explanation of this mystery. Most people know what it's like to feel thoroughly oppressed by their everyday life and to want to simply run away from problems. The inadequate personality feels like that all the time, which explains why, as Stekel says, he's often a drifter. He keeps on running away. There's an exhilarating finality about fire. For example, if you burn old love letters or diaries, it's like watching your own past go up in flames. In a weak, vacillating person, flames may become associated with a feeling of delight and relief, just as the Russian physiologist Pavlov taught dogs to salivate when he rang a bell because they associated it with dinner. So the pyromaniac starts fires because each one brings this sense of relief, of a new start, as well as satisfying a basic resentment against the civilization that oppresses him. The pyromaniac burglar, cited by DeRiver, did not always set fire to the apartment. Sometimes he only lowered his trousers and defecated on the carpet. This seems to prove the association between fire and resentment. Finally, it's easy to understand how two completely different forms of relief, fire and sex, can become associated in the same Pavlovian way. This, then, is probably the basic psychology of the pyromaniac. There is evidence to suggest that, to some extent, it applies to all criminals who use fire as their final solution. For some deep, atavistic reason, human beings have the feeling that fire can solve any problem whose solution seems to demand total destruction. This explains why witches and heretics were burned, and why the Nazis constructed ovens in their death camps. We can also see the same psychology at work in the case of Alfred Rouse, the English burning car murderer, and of the aptly named Samuel Furniss, whose crime was probably inspired by Rouse. Alfred Arthur Rouse suffered a personality change after a head injury in the First World War, and the ex-choir boy became an obsessive womaniser. A commercial traveller for a firm that sold braces and garters, he seduced and impregnated many a shop girl and barmaid encountered on his travels. By 1930, his life was in chaos, his finances hopelessly overstrained, and he daydreamed of quietly disappearing and starting afresh. On November the 5th, 1930, he set about achieving this by giving a lift to an unidentified man, probably a tramp. At 2 in the morning, he halted in a quiet lane near the village of Hardingstone and somehow knocked his companion unconscious. Then he placed the body in the driving seat, doused the car in petrol, and set it alight. But two passing youths saw him fleeing the scene, and Rouse's description was published in the newspapers. He was with yet another mistress in Gaeligaia, Wales, when he realised beyond doubt that his plan had misfired and decided to give himself up. Under arrest, Rouse claimed that he had been relieving his bowels in a field when his passenger had set himself ablaze by lighting a cigarette after refilling the tank with petrol. But Sir Bernard Spilsbury demolished that story when he told of finding a fragment of petrol-soaked rag trapped between the corpse's legs. Rouse confessed before he was hanged on March the 10th, 1931. In January 1933, Furniss, a builder of Camden Town, North London, killed a rent collector named Spatchett, stole £40 he was carrying, and then incinerated the body by setting fire to a shed that served him as an office. The corpse was assumed to be that of Furniss, until the pathologist noticed that it had been shot in the back of the head. A nationwide murder hunt for Furniss followed. he wrote a letter to his brother-in-law asking him to meet him in Southend-on-Sea, near London, and the brother-in-law informed the police. In prison, Furness managed to poison himself by drinking a bottle of hydrochloric acid that had been sewn into the lining of his coat. A detailed study of the case reveals that Furness was undoubtedly an inadequate personality. To begin with, he was not, like Rouse, heavily in debt, only to the extent of £90, and his suicide revealed the same basic failure to face up to the consequences of his own actions. The psychology of inadequacy can be seen in an otherwise somewhat commonplace murder that took place in Ypsilanti, Michigan, in 1931. Three ex-convicts had been drinking moonshine whiskey, and then decided to go out and rob someone. They found four 16-year-olds in a car in a lover's lane, held them up, and robbed them of $2. One of the girls was then dragged out of the car and raped. The others resisted, and all were battered to death or shot. The robbers next set the car on fire. Because of numerous clues they left behind, they were placed under arrest within a few hours. A court tried the case and sentenced them to life imprisonment in record time. There was a howling mob outside the courthouse hoping to lynch the men. A more recent American case makes the link between incendiarism and inadequacy even plainer. Jerry Cornwell was a 32-year-old mechanic who lived in Oakland, California. Until a few weeks before Christmas 1955, he had lived with his mistress, an ex-waitress, Alice Franklin, who was 3 years older than himself. Then Alice transferred her affections to a 27-year-old steelworker, Robert Hand. Cornwell quietly moved out of the apartment. He actually remained on fairly good terms with his ex-mistress and her lover, and on the night of the murder had been at a party with them. He was drunk and followed them back home to 5955 Telegraph Avenue, hiding outside the bedroom window, and he watched them make love, then fall into an alcoholic slumber. He went to a nearby garage, bought 3 gallons of petrol, then walked into the bedroom where the lovers snored on, and drenched the bed in petrol. As he went out, the pilot light of the stove ignited the petrol fumes. Firemen rushed the victims to hospital, but both died a few hours later. The police had no difficulty in locating Cornwell, who confessed. An interesting legal point arose at the trial. Whether Cornwell could be charged with murder when he had not actually struck the match that ignited the petrol? The judge, however, pointed out that it was undoubtedly his intention to kill his mistress and her lover, and he was found guilty and sentenced to life imprisonment. Cornwell's inadequacy appears throughout, handing over the apartment to his rival, remaining friendly with the lovers, following them back to the apartment to watch them make love, a strong touch of masochism here, and the blind rage that is so typical of the inadequate personality when pushed too far. No account of fire raisers would be complete without some account of the German Rouse cases, although in many ways they fail to fit into the general pattern of pyromania. The first case actually took place a year before Rouse murdered an unknown tramp on the Northampton Road. Kurt Erich Tessner was also a commercial traveller, but in 1929 business was poor. One day his mother-in-law told him that she had cancer and that her only hope was an operation. Her chances of surviving it were only 50-50. Tetzner dissuaded her, but just long enough to insure her life for the equivalent of £500. Because of her cancer, he was unable to make it more. Then he persuaded her to have the operation after all. His gamble paid off. She died 3 days later. Tetzner was amazed and charmed at the ease with which one could get money out of the insurance companies. He discussed with his wife how they could repeat the coup. She suggested a plan that was virtually the same as Rouse's, to get a body from a graveyard and to burn it in his own car. Tetzner disagreed about the graveyard. There must be blood around, he said. He tried advertising for a travelling companion. A young man applied, but something in Tetzner's manner made him suspicious, and he changed his mind. Next, Tetzner picked up a hitchhiker on the road to Munich. The man's name was Alois Ortner, and he was an out-of-work mechanic. In a town called Hof, Tetzner gave him money to have a shave and to buy himself a collar and tie. Then, outside the town, he asked the mechanic to check an oil leak under the car. As soon as the man disappeared, Tetzner seized a hammer and an ether pad. If he had waited until Ortner's head appeared and then hit him while he was still under the car, Tetzner might have succeeded. But in his excitement, he allowed Ortner to emerge before he attacked him. The mechanic fought back fiercely, then ran away into the woods. But apparently he failed to report the incident. On November the 25th, 1929, Tetzner picked up another hitchhiker, a thinly clad youth of 21, whose name Tetzner never found out. The youth complained of being cold, so Tetzner wrapped him in a travelling rug. When his arms were tightly pinioned, he grabbed a piece of rope and strangled the youth. Near Ettershausen, he crashed the car into a tree, put the body in the driving seat, and sprinkled it with petrol. Then he laid a trail of petrol back to the car and set it on fire. Tetzner was more fortunate than Rouse. He was not seen as he ran away. The burnt-out car was found. His wife identified the corpse as that of her husband, and it was buried. She now applied to the insurance company for the 145,000 marks for which Tetzner had insured his life. That's more than £13,000 in present-day terms. However, the insurance officials were suspicious. To begin with, the slightly built corpse was not really like Tetzner. They contacted Leipzig police, who kept a man on permanent duty watching Frau Tetzner. During the next few days, she was twice called to the telephone in her neighbour's flat. The neighbour told the police that the call was from Strasbourg and that the caller identified himself as Herr Stranelli. The police then asked their Strasbourg colleagues to check on Herr Stranelli, who was probably thick-set, had a pudgy face and pig-like eyes. When a detective from Leipzig arrived, the Strasbourg police already had Stranelli in custody. It was, as they had suspected, Tetzner. Tetzner at first confessed to the murder, then withdrew the confession. His story in court was that he had accidentally knocked down the young man and killed him. He had placed the corpse in the boot of his car and gone for supper. During the meal, he suddenly realised he could now carry out his plan to disappear. A forensic expert from Leipzig University supported his story, saying that injuries to the body suggested it had been run over. But the jury disbelieved it, and Tetzner was condemned to death. He was executed at Regensburg on May the 2nd, 1931. A young man named Fritz Safran read about Tetzner's crime with great interest. He was the manager of a large furniture store, Platz & Co., in Rastenburg. To all appearances, the store appeared to be prosperous. In fact, it was nearly bankrupt. Safran had been selling the furniture on hire purchase, and during the Depression his customers were simply not paying. Herr Platz, the owner, was perfectly happy to leave the management of the store in the hands of the brilliant young manager, for Safran not only paid him a generous pension, but was also his son-in-law. In fact, Safran was having an affair with the girl who kept the accounts, a strong-minded young woman named Ella Augustin, and was planning on disappearing with her. He had also taken into his confidence the chief clerk, Erik Kipnik. The plan was to insure Safran's life heavily, plant a body in the store, and then set the store on fire. The problem was where to obtain a body. Their original plan, of digging one up from a grave, was rejected. The three of them then set up camp in the Nikolai Forest, and every morning Kipnik and Safran would each drive off in his car, looking for a victim. At their trial, it transpired that they had made several unsuccessful attempts. One man who got into the car with all three of them said he had six children, so they let him go. On another occasion, Ella lost her nerve while Kipnik was pounding a man with a life preserver and allowed the person to go alive and free. Finally, they found a suitable victim, a young man on a bicycle. Safran later said that Kipnik had got out of the car and shot him, while Kipnik blamed Safran. The corpse was duly taken to the store. For some reason, the conspirators delayed starting the fire. The dead man, a dairyman named Dahl, was killed on September the 12th, 1930. But it was not until the evening of the 15th that a tremendous explosion shook the store. Many employees who were inside miraculously escaped safely. Kipnik, apparently in hysterics, declared that Safran had rushed into the flames to try to save the account books. Later, a charred body was found. 2 weeks after the fire, a chauffeur named Reck was asked by Ella to call at her house and to drive her mother to Königsberg. A man came out of the house and the chauffeur recognised Safran. He talked about this, and his gossip came to the ears of the police. Their inquiries soon revealed the motive for the crime, that the store was nearly bankrupt. The manhunt for Safran began. He was hiding in Berlin with a relation of Ella Augustin's, a poor carpenter. In early November, he stole the carpenter's identity papers and boarded a train for Hamburg, from where he hoped to escape to America. However, an old army acquaintance recognised him at the Spandau station and notified the police. Safran was arrested, and he, Kipnik and Ella Augustin appeared in the same dock in Bartenstein, East Prussia, in March of 1931. They pleaded for sympathy, begged the victim's wife tearfully for forgiveness, and tried to blame each other. The two men were sent to prison for life. Ella received 5 years. Today, electronic fire alarms, fireproof building materials and automatic sprinklers are making arson one of the rarest of crimes. There's no reason why in a civilised society fire should not be stamped out like the bubonic plague. We may hope that the curious perversion known as pyromania may one day disappear of its own accord. One thing, however, that is not in doubt is that when Prometheus, in Greek mythology, stole fire from the gods and brought it to Earth, he did not live up to his name, which meant forethinker. He literally did not know the conflagration he was starting, and for his crime he was riveted to a rock by Zeus, who daily sent an eagle to tear out the prisoner's liver, which was then renewed each night. A cruel, but in mythological terms, just punishment.